What would your world be like if it was flat? So, if the world was flat?
There would be no sunrise.
You imagine with me.
I wouldn't be living in Hobart. It's all hills.
Well, so I'm thinking like those who used to believe the world was not spherical. Used to.
Or you could fall off it.
You could fall off it. Yeah.
There'd be an end to it.
There'd be an end. Yeah, so your world would have an end.
There'd be an underneath that you knew nothing about.
Yeah, okay. There'd be a... Yeah, hold on. You'd presume there's an underneath there.
Well, dimensions.
Dimensions, yeah. And what happens when you get to the end and you fall off the end?
How deep in high school...
Yeah. Sorry?
Like, how far do I have to drill to fall through the bottom?
He jumps really hard.
Yeah.
Yep.
According to gravity, the further, the closer you got to the edge, the more difficult it would be to walk up the thing.
There you go. All right. Well, your world would certainly be smaller, wouldn't it? And you'd think there's less people because you'd be like, well, there's the edge of it. So it can't be any bigger. I think the world would seem maybe a bit more terrifying and mysterious. You know, what is on the edge? What happens if I go over the edge? Back in the time when this was the thought, I think this was some of the stuff that people had. You know, I think that they thought the world kind of ended at Africa, apparently. And it's like a disc floating in an ocean. And so kind of the water around is the kind of, it's almost like the spirit kind of divine sort of thing. Do you know Narnia? Is it Narnia where they go, they keep going to the edge and then they kind of come into the shore? Yeah. So there's you know, kind of almost something a bit like that. Now, if you were told it's not round, it's spherical, how do you reckon you'd feel? Imagine this is like really, truly what you believe, right? Yeah, Dave.
Keep thinking of those things like, then why do we make it flat, make it curved? Why are buildings curved? Why are they straight? Why are shoes made flat?
No, well, if you're confronted with the reality, the truth, that... that the world is actually round.
Well, maybe you'd think that was as silly as we think it's flat.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, you'd think that concept was a silly idea because you're so used to the flat, round concept.
Yeah, you'd think it's silly. Mm. Yeah, I mean, you think flat earth people, do you think they're not silly? Sorry if you're a flat earth person.
Okay.
I mean, I think there'd be something pretty confronting in it to be told that your whole world is actually different. Like, what does that mean for where you go? What else is there? What else is out there? Everything I've been thinking of is now different. I think being it's very hard to imagine what it would be like in that situation. But I think just generally being exposed to truth, especially truth like that, it can be really hard, it can be provocative, and it causes all sorts of reactions, and it would probably cause all sorts of reaction from you if you were a sailor, for instance. Now, when it comes to deciding what you kind of do with that truth, you know, you're going to respond with something like, it's silly, it's not true. You know, you can downplay it and go, oh, maybe not really. You can disapprove of it. You can deny it. You can probably dismiss it. You'd have all sorts of reactions to this truth. You may have found that in other areas of your life, possibly where you've heard something and you're like, no, that can't be the case. That's not true. No way. Well, as we come to our passage tonight, and we cast our mind to the story that's just happened, We see that Jesus is arrested and he's put on trial by the Jews, isn't he? By the Romans and by everyone, in fact. As we move through the passage, and especially as we go into chapter 19, you see that continues. He is put on trial by the world. And that's how it normally looks to us and to me. And we call it his trial after all, yeah, the trial of Jesus. Yet John wants to show you in the passage tonight another perspective, that actually it is the world that's being put on trial. It's the other way round. And Jesus is going to confront it, cause it to face the truth in this last hour, for the last time, about who he is. What his own is that he's come to actually think of him, and how they're going to act on that knowledge. And what's the truth they need to face? Well, not that the earth is flat, but that Jesus, the Son, is making God known to the world, and that he is the one to know if you want to know God, meet him, be in the right with him. And that's what he's been claiming so far all the way through John. This truth is the light that shines in the darkness, the truth that exposes and shows up all that is false and faulty in the world. This truth is both confronting and comforting. Confronting because it exposes, and comforting because by the truth we're saved and come to enjoy life with God. You see, Uni Fellowship, how the world engages with the truth gives away their position, doesn't it? And so you and I are prompted to consider what our position is to this truth. Where do we stand? You know, we can glide through a whole host of things in life and sit comfortably ignoring or determinedly wishing away inconveniences. But when confronted with Jesus, you have to figure out your view of this truth. What opinion or verdict, perhaps, might you share at this point in semester? Four interactions with the truth take place in this trial, and four verdicts are exposed on the way to Jesus being lifted up. So let's take some time to have a look at them. The trial in your passage there begins at the disciples' local hangout. So the first point is the truth downplayed. You are Jesus of Nazareth. Judas, who left early to arrange Jesus' capture, has returned, leading the Jewish and Roman authorities to this spot. It's a heavyweight task force of officials, around kind of 600 soldiers are coming for Jesus. And Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked, "Who is it that you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and they fell to the ground. Knowing all that was going to happen to him, verse 4, he went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" Jesus knows how this night is going to unfold. He isn't caught off guard or on the back foot with this night's sting operation. Don't ever think that his arrest or his trial is a mess that Jesus never saw coming, a massive kind of judgment of error on his behalf and a totally botched movement that he was trying to start. Jesus has explicitly predicted his death multiple times, publicly and privately. He'll be hated, betrayed, be lifted up, and be disowned. He knows what is in store this night. Yet, he went out. He asked. Uni Fellowship, don't miss the juxtaposition of that verse. You don't expect someone to go out to their arrest. You wouldn't. I wouldn't. You run, you hide, you evade, you panic if you're in a walled garden. "Look, behind you!" And then you run away. You're outnumbered. You're outgunned. If Jesus knew all that was going to happen to him, why did he go out and ask? Because he's forcing them to acknowledge what they're doing with him. What they do with him is answering the question, where do you stand with me? What do you think of me? He's turning the tables and he's taking to task the task force that's come to get him. So the Jews and the Gentiles answer him, we seek Jesus of Nazareth. I am, is his reply. Their response, get the handcuffs, governor. No. They drew back and they fell to the ground. What is going on there? Their approach, their address, they are set about stumbling by his name. There is something in his name. Do you see it? Something here that needs to be reckoned with, that they've just been hit with. I am is the truth about who Jesus is, you see. And it sends us back to Jesus' claims about himself. I am. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the gate. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection of the life. I am the way, the truth, the life. I am the vine. And before Abraham was, I am. I am points to his identity and what has to be done with that. Uni Fellowship, you got to do something with that. It is the term I am that is used as the Hebrew name of God. That reminds us and it reveals to them, who are they really asking for? This gives us a clue, right? This is a bad idea. Are you sure you want to go through with this? Are you sure? He says his name and you're knocked to your knees. Are you sure? You'd pack up and go home, wouldn't you? I know, I probably would. So Jesus asked them again, who is it you want? And I think this is another chance for them to kind of acknowledge the reality of actually just what they've encountered. To reassess what they're going to do, who they're going to ask for. And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus answered, I told you that I'm he. Their answer gives away their opinion of who they think Jesus is, or at least how they want to see him. The truth they just had revealed powerfully before them and been impacted by, and what should send you and I thinking and flicking back to, it just does little. Their answer is to say, maybe more politely this time, the normal man from that region, please. Or at best, a Nazarene, who was one that showed he was a serious kind of devoted dude to God. The a bit special spiritual guy, him, you, we want to arrest and bring to trial. They downplay the truth, don't they? They wouldn't keep going with their mission if they didn't. And perhaps this rings true for you. Is our response to who you're looking for one also that lowers the bar, despite the clear impression that Jesus gives? You may have experienced the impact in a small or big way in your life, maybe here, even at Uni Fellowship. Maybe a prior church thing, that particular conversation you had with that person that just hit you. Yet you rather just pick yourself up, brush yourself down, be unmoved and undeterred. Let me ask you, will you consider your reply again? Come back to that moment, reconsider the way that you have been, or maybe you are being affected by Jesus' character. So Jesus answers, if you're looking for me, then let these men go. This happened so the words he'd spoken would be fulfilled. I've not lost one of those you gave me. Jesus gives himself in. He isn't taken. And we know he does this willingly because he's just proved he can overcome them, right? Like the good shepherd who defends his flock, Jesus lays down his life and doesn't run. He gives himself up. He secures the release of his followers. It's about him, not them. You see, what Jesus promised and declared, he is doing, and he will accomplish, won't he? Jesus isn't the I am possibly, or I hope I am when the time comes. We're not dealing with someone who says one thing and does another, claims a lot, but is all hot air. He is true to the truth that he has claimed. Yeah? And this is why Peter's move is so massively, embarrassingly misguided. Then Peter, Simon, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's ear, right ear, cutting it off. His name was Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? Because it gets in the way of who Jesus is and what he's on about. So then the detachment of soldiers with his commander and the Jewish officials arrest Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it would be good if one man died for them. Downplaying the truth. So from the resting party to the one who disapproves of truth, because it doesn't fit his loves and values. So we've changed scenes at verse 15, if you have a look there, and arrive with Peter just outside where Jesus is being interrogated. And we'll come back outside, though, to the fireplace in a moment. So verse 19, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. I've spoken openly to the world, Jesus replied. I've always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. Nobody's got a secret YouTube video of him at a fundraiser or Utah's uni saying things to an inside group that he really doesn't want the public to know about. He doesn't have a different message privately to publicly. Not one for his followers and one for the crowds and the Jewish leaders. He is standing on his testimony he's given. Jesus here before the high priest, the one who is assigned to stand between God and the people, that mediator, that representative, that pinnacle of speaking and maintaining God's will and ways before such a great man. The Jewish highest leader, he isn't changing what he spoke about openly, tweaking it, redacting it, negotiating a deal to suppress it. Jesus has laid it all out plainly to Jew and Roman. The world has heard. You see, Jesus spins the cross examination around and says, stop interrogating the defendant, talk to the witnesses. Hear them and make up your mind on that truth. That is what tells you all that you need to know about who I am. The high priest needs to reckon with that. And he does. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest? He demanded. If I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? Then Annas sent him, still bound, to Caiaphas, the high priest. The response is pretty dirty. It's revealing. Jesus' restraint is amazing. Mine wouldn't have been. The high priest isn't interested or on board with Jesus' message, is he? It doesn't fit with his beliefs, his values, and definition of truth. Or at least he's making sure it doesn't. Actually, he thinks Jesus is dangerous and is convinced he will damage his position of power and privilege that they have with the Romans. See, who's his son-in-law? Caiaphas. This reason of privilege and power was not just a family issue and a high priest's one. But the entire leadership, strata of religious society, and chain of command. Thrown back to chapter 11, we read, therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did, put their faith in him. He's getting a gathering. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. All the heavyweight dudes are there, all the leadership. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is the man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest this year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the whole, for the people, and the whole nation perish. Caiaphas was the one who advised the Jews that it would be good if one man died for the people. Protect our patch. Protect our place. That's what it's on about. The truth Jesus is bringing and spreading is intolerable. The Jewish leaders fear because of this, that they're going to lose out. Jesus is going to rock the boat, ruin the status quo. And that risks them losing everything. Everything that is dear to them. And Caiaphas is moving this. It's to smother the truth, isn't it? He wants to make it go away. Jesus has been exposing the officials for what they are. Broken, selfish people before a holy God. And so someone's head needs to roll. Namely, Jesus's. It's just another instance of human ego being offended by God's truth. The high priest's line of questioning, the apparent acceptable smack to the face, his silence at Jesus' question, asking him, tell me what's wrong, is answered only with sending Jesus back, bound. Ananias is not only showing Jesus to be innocent by this move, but he exposes the state of his heart. And do you reckon, guys, that we can end up engaging with Jesus like this? I wonder if your approach to Jesus is one that also has sometimes a bit of a combative edge, a bit critical, even cruel. The reason may be because he's exposing something that you feel threatened by. Threatens what you love and value, right? And when that happens, it's easier, more convenient, more comfortable to suppress it, lest you lose it. Just want to speak to you guys, if you identify as a Christian particularly here, just a second. When those contentious subjects do arise, like Jesus's perspective on things like sex, on marriage, on singleness and gender, even throwing back to the abortion comment by Paul earlier, do you find yourself minimizing your input? Or saying, oh yeah, but this and this, and let me take you back to that. Or just very largely agreeing with another person's position. And by it, you suppress the truth. You keep that beach ball down because you want to keep the peace. Lest you upset the cart, right? And maybe for you guys who don't yet identify as a Christian, you might be starting to feel a little bit of heat in some areas of your life that the reality of this truth is bringing. Beginning to be aware of what you might need to give up, put down, and let go of doing and being. Because you see that it's going to disturb and shake up the harmony within yourself and within your family and your friends and your uni life. You'd rather keep on and keep hold of and keep doing those things. Now, as the tension is felt in these, it's hard, and I get that. I find it hard too. But remember, uni fellowship, that the truth is better. Let me tell you, it's better. It's more freeing, it's more real, it's more life-giving. Before the high priest stands the one who the high priest and the whole temple and whole sacrificial system pointed to and finds its full glory in. It's not even the Day of Atonement. Here is God disclosing himself before Aeneas in Jesus the Son. Don't miss that. They won't lose their place. They are being given it all in Jesus. The truth before him will give them the true place that they actually want. In Jesus, they, you, can let go of wrong loves and wrong values and find them reshaped and replaced with what is better. That's what Jesus is accomplishing here. And that's what the truth is going to do. It's better. So next to the one who denies the truth and is ashamed of it. At the same time, back outside, kind of dual scenes is going on here. It's pretty cool. Peter is warming himself by a fire and a different scene is unfolding. He's approached three times and asked if he knows Jesus, and he gives three responses. So first, the girl at the door who's let him in says, "You're not one of his disciples, are you?" He replied, "I am not." Someone around the fire asks him, probably part of the task force responsible for arresting Jesus earlier, "Has Simon Peter stood warning himself?" He was asked, "You're not one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it, saying, "I am not." And a servant who was the relative of Malchus, that's why we got that name earlier, whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him, "Didn't I see you in the olive grove?" Again, Peter denied it. And at that moment, the rooster began to crow. John is setting up a contrast here, right, between Jesus and Peter. Peter is being led. Jesus has been leading. He came out. Peter is directed by the question. Jesus is directing questions. Peter is reactive. Jesus is predictive. Peter says three times the opposite line to Jesus. "I am not he." Early that night, during Jesus' last teaching, a conversation had taken place. Let me just take you back there. Simon Peter asked him, "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus replied, "Where I'm going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later." Peter asked, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? I'll lay my life down for you." Then Jesus answered, "Will you really lay your life down for me? I tell you the truth, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times." Peter has passionately declared his commitment to Jesus to the end. He's followed Jesus this far, yet when faced with holding to his loyalty here, coming through on his love for Jesus around the fire, at each Q and A exchange, Peter increases his denial of being associated with Jesus. And it's this, isn't it, that shows where Peter actually stands with Jesus. What does Peter deny? Knowing and being involved with Jesus. Peter disassociates with Jesus because he's ashamed of him. His failure to say, "I am with him, I am one of his, that was me," is to deny the truth. Peter prefers to be associated with those who are part of the world than those who follow him. Jesus is inside calling witnesses to those who have heard his teaching, and Peter is outside denying him. Jesus has been defending his disciples and not giving them away. Peter is disloyal and disowning him. The rooster crows, and what Jesus has anticipated happens. Jesus exposes Peter's position to the truth. What he has done is obvious. So I just want to ask you guys where your association lies. I mean, in the moment when a point of connection is made between you and him. You know, when the inquiry or the question comes about our faith, our life choices, the stuff that we're involved in, and why? When we're spotted with those people at that thing, liking that post, wearing that t-shirt, maybe having that drink bottle, which kind of reveals our Jesus preference leanings. Who do you affirm and who do you deny? I don't think you particularly need to be a follower of Jesus in this case. But that's only one way. You see, you can be avoiding the exposure of your Christianity and be shunning an allegiance to the truth by hiding behind others, sitting in someone else's shadow, being just further enough back to be missed, lost in the crowd, and just simply being that person that just is strategically sidestepping association with Jesus at every turn, and maybe even just making flat out denial. Did you opt out really from O Week because you were embarrassed by the comments that might follow when you were discovered? Have you been limiting involvement with Uni Fellowship because you're just wanting to keep intact the respect of your old schoolmates and not appear unsophisticated to your new classmates by holding to this stuff too much? Maybe just shrinking back and being super apologetic when you're caught with a Bible open in somewhere like Laziness. Remember Peter, though. When it comes to those moments of our failures, when I fail, I feel like Peter. Or the pinch that you might be feeling as you're working out what counting the cost of being a Christian is. Peter did that. Jesus hadn't finished with him yet. Peter may have denied the truth, yet, as we've just had alluded to in the garden, Jesus is the Good Shepherd. He is laying his life down for his flock so they can remain his. Be kept his, reinstated even as his. So guys, you can be safe and you can be secure in the truth, even in those times when you do fail to associate with it, okay? So next is on to one who is dismissive of truth. Doesn't want to deal with it, and so hear it. We meet Pontius Pilate, Roman governor. He and the Jews next pull some power moves on each other. I wish I could go into the way they power move each other. It's awesome. And then Pilate goes in to question Jesus. The focus of Pilate's cross-examination of Jesus is kingship. That's the angle that the Jews are using to get Jesus tried. Prove Jesus's kingly claims, those Messiah ones, that instantly becomes a national security issue, a threat to Caesar, the empire, and that will be swiftly eliminated. Hurrah, we've got him. Jesus picks up this line of questioning that Pilate's bringing, and he carefully directs it, clarifying its meaning and implications in the case of kingship. Jesus is actually the one leading Pilate for his own hearing. It's awesome. And there's a couple of important parts about kingship that Jesus makes that forces a response from Pilate. First, his kingship is not of this world. And secondly, his kingdom is one of truth. First, his kingdom is not of this world. Verse 36. Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place." Now, his kingdom not from this world. It doesn't mean that he has stepped through a portal from another dimension, another time in space. And if you'd seen the world that he'd kind of stepped through, you'd kind of get all his rule. he hasn't kind of popped out of the divine ethra and materialized in the human material realm. It doesn't mean that his kingdom isn't active in the world and kind of just has nothing whatsoever to do with it. But instead, think of a totally different order, okay? That is what not of this world means. Now, John in this story is often using the word world to primarily mean all that is orientated against God, all that is loveless in the world, all that is disobedient about the world. It doesn't mean so much this physical planet or simply noting kind of people. It's precisely those associated with this order of the world who have actually come together and got Jesus to this place, right? Jesus' kingdom is not part of this orientation. That makes sense then why those in the kingdom don't take up arms. That feature isn't in keeping with this other order. And that, by the way, just kind of as a side note, is an example of why Christianity isn't a militant faith. Why Christians never further their cause through aggression. Submit or die is an attitude actually associated, is an attitude associated with a system and a practice that's actually turned away from God rather than is for God or on behalf of God. Second, his kingdom is one of truth. You are a king then, said Pilate. Jesus answered, you are right in saying I'm a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. What is truth? Pilate asked. With this he went out. It is because the kingdom is one of truth that it operates differently to the world who doesn't hold to truth. Jesus has come out as king to make truth, make known truth to it. Jesus is disclosing the truth of God, the truth of salvation, of judgment, of humanity's position before him. It's amazing because a world in darkness is not left in the dark, but through the light is having the good news of truth shone upon it. And this truth is found in Jesus. And this truth, it's not a negative, but it's a positive. And it's wonderful, in fact. Why? Well, because it's by accepting this truth, by believing that Jesus is the Messiah, the King, the Son of God, you have life in his name. That is how this another world has everything to do with that which is turned against God, the world. Jesus has entered it and he's called people out from the world to join a totally different order. And I find that astonishing. I wonder if you do. And this is how subjects are made and how you experience his saving kingship. And it makes sense that those who relate rightly to the truth listen to it. So can you see what Jesus is doing with Pilate here? The man in the dock is inviting his judge to be his follower, to align himself with those who are on the side of truth, to recognize truth, to recognize him, to show it by listening. What's he going to do with that? Pilate's response, what is truth? With this, he went out. He dismisses the truth because he doesn't want to deal with it. That would mean listening to it, wouldn't it? Listening to Jesus, yeah? Giving him a proper hearing that would mean he'd have to bother with it. He'd have to face it. Make a decision on it. And it's easy to dismiss the truth, isn't it? It's easier, Uni Fellowship, to just say, everyone has their own truth, and what is true for you is true for me. It's much easier just to say that Jesus was a mythical figure from the past. It's Much easier just to say that he was a good teacher that brought an inspiring message. It's much easier just to say he is one of many prophets. It's much easier just to say he is one God of many, that he is one of many ways to God. And it's easier just to say he's outdated and of a different generation. When faced with Jesus, what might dismissing the truth look like for you? Don't miss the irony of what you might be doing, if that's the case. Jesus, the truth, is right there. So with this, he went out to the Jews and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him, but it's your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in a rebellion. Those who arrested Jesus downplayed the truth. The high priest disapproved of it. Peter denied it. And Pilate was dismissive of it. Jesus has been in control, forcing them to acknowledge what they're doing. When confronted, they reject it. That's what they all do. And that's what is underneath it all. That's the common thread. That's the foundation. They reject it. And that's how Jesus' betrayal, arrest, and trial ends. Verse 40, have a look. They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas. Give us one like the world in place of the truth. Give us one like us." So who really is on trial here? This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by truth comes into light so that it may be seen plainly that what he has been done through God. So many people go through life without really evaluating what they're doing with Jesus, because it's just easy to postpone a decision than to make one. So Jesus says, "Unifellowship, who do you think I am? What are you going to do with me?" And Unifellowship, this is the truth that we're built around. And that we want to hold to, yeah? It is the truth that our world rejects, yet we are invited to accept, that many of us have accepted. Will you keep living by this truth, walking in the light? Let's be those who put it on show, like Jesus did, so those who seek it, who are on its side, who encounter it, will be drawn to it, will find what we have. Will find life with God in it. And a life that's totally reordered and remade by it. That is what the truth does. Let me pray. Lord and God, thank you so much that you sent your Son into the world to make known what is true. Thank you that we can know the truth, and by the truth we're set free. We know this truth can be confronting because it shows us who we really are. But yet we know it's wonderfully comforting because in it we have life. Thank you for that offer, that invitation, making that available to us. and we ask that we would accept it, we would keep accepting it, that we wouldn't be those who downplay it, disapprove of it, deny it, or are dismissive of it, but love it. In Jesus' name, amen.